Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and you're listening to Words on Film on WBCALP Boston. I will be reviewing some of the newest movies out right now.
For this show, I actually have five relatively new films, four of which I can consider brand new. The other one is not quite as new, but it's a one that I'm getting to right now, but it's not too old. It just came out the weekend of April 20th, as opposed to the weekend of April 26th through 28th. But I'm going to start with the film that is arguably the newest and probably the most distributed. The first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Challengers. This is an American romantic sports drama film directed by Luca Guadagnino. And this director is not quite as well known as other directors like Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese, but he is making a name for himself. Even though this is an American film, Luca Guadagnino is actually an Italian director. And by Italian, I mean he was born and raised in Italy, Sicily to be specific. And the films that he has directed include probably most notably the movie Call Me By Your Name from 2017, which did well critically and somewhat commercially for a movie of that caliber. I thought it was particularly overrated, but he also directed the movie Suspiria about a year later in 2018. And last year he directed a film called Bones and All, which I actually did not get to see, but I hear a lot of things about it. So Challengers, very much like the movie Call Me By Your Name, is not only a romantic drama film, but it's also about some unconventional relationships. In this case, the plot follows a professional champion who is played by Mike Feist. I hope that's how I pronounce his name. Who plots a comeback with the help of his wife, who's played by Zendaya. And Zendaya's character is a former tennis prodigy who retired after an injury. And meanwhile, her husband is going up against another player by the name of Josh O'Connor, who also happens to be his former best friend and his wife's former lover. So there is a lot that's going on here. And the movie is told in a non-linear fashion. As I told you previously, the champion in this film is played by Mike Feist, and his character's name is Art Donaldson, and his former ally turned sports adversary in the game of tennis is Patrick Zweig. And the two of them, when they meet face-to-face in a tournament in New Rochelle, New York, which is not the biggest tournament in which they are competing, but is the first step towards their bigger tournament, they couldn't be more different. For example, Art Donaldson is not only married to Zendaya's character Tashi Duncan, but he also has a daughter, and his prospects are big. And even though he hasn't made it to the U.S. Open again to solidify his status as a celebrated professional tennis player, he's already secured a number of endorsements. On the other hand, Patrick Zweig, Josh O'Connor's character, is kind of like an athlete's athlete. He not only plays very well, but he also lives a bit of a nomadic life. He usually can't afford hotel rooms, so he sleeps in his car. He's not married, he's not committed to anyone, but he and Zendaya's character Tashi Duncan certainly have a history. And for that matter, he has a history with Art Donaldson as well. After all, the two had known each other since they were children and had even competed on the same team. I might be spoiling a little bit of the middle here, but I'm definitely not spoiling the ending. And the cinematography and the choreography of these tennis matches, particularly where Art Donaldson and Patrick Zweig go up against one another, are really, really well shot. As a matter of fact, not only is the editing and the cinematography really good, I also thought the sound effects were excellent. And the sound editor, whose name I actually don't know, but I could probably look that up a little later, was very clever in the sense that the more intense that the tennis game was that was going on in this movie, the louder the sound of the ball hitting the racket was. I thought that was very good. And this movie has certainly got a lot of attention for a particularly provocative scene where there's a threesome between Mike Feist, Zendaya, and Josh O'Connor. That a lot of people know that scene is coming from the trailers, and a lot of people have taken that scene and made memes about it, but it is an intriguing scene, and I think it develops the plot, not to mention the love triangle here, very well. But it's not the best part of the film, or at least it's not the most memorable part of the film. There are some more subtle parts that work really well here, especially when Zendaya is on the sidelines watching her husband and his arch rival play against one another. There's a lot to her body movement that I think makes this Zendaya's best film in which she's acted. And there's a lot of pressure on her in this movie because this is the very first film that I know of that is Zendaya's starring role. Usually she's played a lot of supporting roles, but here she's center stage, even though she's not the one who's actually competing. But a lot rests on her, and she has to basically deal with her husband advancing in his career, not to mention a prior commitment to her ex-boyfriend or her ex-lover. So there's a lot that's going on here, and this is a film that was initially supposed to be released in September of 2023, and it was pulled out from its slot from the opening, being the opening film of the 80th Venice International Film Festival, and the reason it was pulled out was because of the 2023 SAG-AFTRA strike. But eventually, it was released into the United States by Amazon MGM Studios on April 26th, 2024. It was actually originally released in Sydney about a month earlier. But this movie was certainly well worth the wait. There is a lot of love triangle things that are going on here. There's some provocative sex scenes. But again, that's not the point of the film. What really matters in this film is the drama between these three characters, and not just on the court. And that's one of the biggest reasons that I loved Challengers a lot more than I loved Call Me By Your Name. It's not just because it's a sports drama in addition to being a romantic drama. It just felt like the characters were more real. All three of them were relatable in one way or another. Sometimes they make very good choices. Sometimes they make very poor choices. But they work well in the context of their character and the context of the story, which is why I give Challengers my rating of a knockout. Of the films that I've seen by Luca Guadagnino, in other words, the ones that he's directed, this one has probably affected me the most. I can't say it's his best because I haven't seen all his films, but it certainly is among his best, and this is a standout performance from Zendaya. But also of note is the actor Mike Feist, who also had previously acted in Steven Spielberg's West Side Story as Riff, the leader of the Jets, and he was excellent in that film as well. He wasn't nominated for any Oscars, but he was nominated for a BAFTA award for Best Supporting Actor, and that was certainly well-deserved, the nomination, and I can't exactly say who won that award, but it certainly put Mike Feist on the map for me, and this movie will certainly put him and Zendaya on another map for me, which is a series of great performances in this film. And from what I've seen of Luca Guadagnino's movies, this one is his best, but I'm not saying it's his very best, but I certainly was very impressed by just about everything in it. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Unsung Hero. This is a Christian drama film that is based on a true story, and the film follows the Smallbone family from Australia, who consist of a husband and wife, as well as several of their children, one of whom is an aspiring singer by the name of Rebecca, whose stage name ultimately became Rebecca St. James, because Rebecca Smallbone, even though, no offense to the people with this last name, it's not a particularly commercially viable name. And that's proven by the fact that Rebecca St. James has gone on to become a very successful Christian artist in her own right. And Unsung Hero is actually directed by Richard Ramsey and Joel Smallbone, the latter of whom portrays his father, David Smallbone, in this film. And Joel Smallbone portrays his father. The role of his mother, Helen Smallbone, in this movie is played by Daisy Betts. And the film takes place in the early 90s. In 1991, David Smallbone is doing very well for himself. Not only does he have a wife and several kids, and they live in a nice house in Australia, but he is a successful concert promoter until his prospects dry up, at which point he moves his family from Australia to Nashville, Tennessee, in pursuit of a new beginning amidst adversity. Now, Australians who move from Australia to the United States have one advantage from other immigrants from other non-English-speaking countries in the sense that they don't have to overcome a language barrier. But still, it is very hard to move anywhere, let alone halfway across the world. But when the Smallbone family move from Australia to Nashville, Tennessee, even though they move to Music City, they find that they have to start all over again. And that is not easy, especially considering that Helen Smallbone is pregnant with their next child. And they experience, of course, numerous challenges, financial struggles being certainly one of them. And they certainly face a lot of struggles and adversity as they are going about their lives. But this film is very inspiring to see this family just start from scratch and try to make it in, of all industries, the music industry, which in the 90s was not as competitive as it is now, considering that the music industry isn't as lucrative as it used to be financially, but it was still a tough field into which to break. And David Smallbone in particular found himself cleaning houses just to make ends meet for his family, even at that. And this movie also has some surprising appearances by other actors we haven't seen in a while, particularly in mainstream films. For example, Jonathan Jackson and Candace Cameron Bure portray neighbors of the Smallbone family in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's kind of jarring to hear Candace Cameron Bure with a Southern accent. But, and I think it's been probably over three decades since Ms. Bure has been in a mainstream film. I think the last one she was in was Some Kind of Wonderful, which was a John Hughes film, and she wasn't in that for very long. She played the youngest sibling of Eric Stoltz's character. But regardless, it definitely shows that this struggle that the Smallbone family went through to land on solid ground in a new territory for them was very hard, but it also, very much like Christian drama films generally do, it shows that they had a lot of faith in themselves as well as higher powers to make it through the hard times. And while I'm not entirely on board with a lot of Christian films, as I've said on this show before, the Christian films that I really don't like are the ones that A, are preachy, and also the ones that imply that if you don't believe in Jesus and tell everyone you know about the Word of God and the power of Jesus Christ, you might as well be a fire-breathing Satanist. Fortunately, Unsung Hero does not fall victim to that kind of plot device that actually, as I've been seeing a lot of Christian films, many Christian films have been getting away from that, and that's very good to know. But honestly, this movie does stick to the story of the Smallbones' struggle to make ends meet, especially in a new world like they are in. And I respect it for that. And I give Unsung Hero my rating of a checkout. I do think that some of the acting is not particularly great in this film. I think sometimes there are some things that happen here that seem a little too convenient and might have been embellished from what actually happened. But I think for a film that is inspiring and something that's not going to offend or drive away Christians, it is a very good film, and it certainly is one of those motivational tools for anyone who has to start over, regardless of whether or not they move to a new country or a new hemisphere for that matter. And I liked Unsung Hero for that reason, and I do think that there may have been some embellishment from Joel Smallbone having co-directed, co-written, and star in this film. I think he might have painted over some of the ugly parts of his upbringing, but I guess that is to be expected from a movie about that's a tribute to your family, particularly your father. But I think this movie hammers its point home about starting over and also about the strength of faith and family very well, and I commend it for that. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Hard Miles. And this is a film that is technically a 2023 film, even though it was released in the United States on April 19th, 2024. It premiered at the Bentonville Film Festival on June 13th, 2023. What took it so long to be released nationwide, if not worldwide? Probably the SAG-AFTRA strike of last year might have had something to do with that, but regardless, it is out in certain theaters right now and has done pretty well on the independent circuit. And this is a film that is about a teacher and a coach by the name of Greg Townsend, who's played by Matthew Modine, who plays a teacher at a school for at-risk boys in Colorado. And he rallies a group of four disgruntled teenage inmates for a transformative 1,000-mile or 1,600-kilometer bicycle ride from Denver, which is where this school-slash-correctional facility is located, to the Grand Canyon, battling obstacles along the way in addition to each other. And the five of them, not only Matthew Modine's character Greg Townsend, who actually is a real person who teaches at one of these correctional institutions in Denver, but also the five students, the five male students, get on bikes that they made themselves and ride all the way from Denver to the Grand Canyon, which takes them quite a while. On the way, there is actually another teacher by the name of Hattie, who's played by an actress by the name of Cynthia McWilliams, who I hadn't seen previously, but she has been on TV shows like Real Husbands of Hollywood, Prison Break, and Nashville, the latter of which I haven't seen. And some people are very shocked that I haven't seen the show Nashville, but I honestly haven't. Maybe I will someday, but I am too busy with catching up with some TV shows that I'm very curious about seeing, in addition to all the movies that I have to see a given week. But Cynthia McWilliams is very good in this film. She is actually following the bicycle riders as they're going from Denver to the Grand Canyon by way of a van. And Matthew Modine's character knows that she's with them. She's not following them nefariously, but if any kind of emergency happens, especially a health emergency to which all five of these guys are vulnerable, considering that they're just on their bikes and they're camping outside when during periods of rest, she's the one who's there to call for help or assist whenever they need help. So I could get into some of the backstories about these four kids, but that would take me a while, and I don't really have time to go through it. I do think that the movie is very inspiring. After all, it kind of goes to show you that when you take the hard way in order to get to a certain destination, sometimes the journey itself is more important than the destination, but getting there is also one of those things that matters in the grand scheme of things. But it's not just the goal, it's the voyage as well. And it's certainly not the first film that I've seen that's like that, but it is particularly inspiring in that regard. I do think that the director, R.J. Daniel Hanna, does tend to, I think, brush over some other parts of the story that might have been more interesting. For example, it seems like some of the montages of these four guys who didn't always get along. In fact, some of them were prone to getting in fights in their hallways back at their school. I feel like some of the meshing and the gelling of these characters as they are working towards the same goal is sometimes brushed over a little bit more from the early montages and makes the story seem a bit more cliche than it was ultimately intended to be. But I did think that the on-location shooting, which I presume was on the same route that Greg Townsend actually took at least some of his students, was filmed on location for this movie. And of course, the scenery and some of the panoramic views are absolutely beautiful here. I also thought that there was a character here by the name of Speedy, or at least that's his nickname, and he's played by Sean Astin, and he plays a bike shop owner and also a confidant of Matthew Modine's character. But I felt like Sean Astin, who's a fine actor, had very little screen time in this film. In fact, I think largely he was only in this film for about 5 minutes. And you would think that for guys who were getting together and making their own bicycles and riding them a significant distance like they are would probably rely on a bike shop owner to help them. And I feel like that was a deleted scene that almost stands out in a bad way from not being included in this film, Hard Miles. But overall, there was a lot more that I liked about this film that I didn't like. And of course, Matthew Modine is an excellent actor, as usual. I also really liked Cynthia McWilliams in this movie, not only as a confidant of Matthew Modine's character, but also somebody who is very reasonable when Matthew Modine's character is particularly unreasonable in his demands and his expectations, not only on his students, but also on himself, especially when he reflects on his abusive upbringing, in addition to some health concerns that he has, and presumably the real life Greg Townsend has as well. So Hard Miles is a film that is particularly enjoyable. I think some of the best scenes are when the riders are doing something challenging, like for example, going up a hill, and you can feel the pain and the anguish that they're feeling when they are pedaling as hard as they can up a hill, which is not particularly easy to do. And for somebody who is not an avid bike rider like myself, when I experience a hill, what I do is I hop off the bike and I walk my bike all the way up. But that's not exactly an option for people who are gung-ho about bicycle riding like Lance Armstrong, for example. And yes, Lance Armstrong has a reputation that is completely shot now, but the idea is he's a competitive bike rider and there are thousands more like him. And of course, Matthew Modine's character in this film, who take bike riding very seriously. And for them, hopping off the bike when the road gets steep is not an option. So Hard Miles is a film that does avert some sports drama cliches, which is great. But I think in some of the editing choices, it did almost inevitably get gravitated towards other sports drama cliches, which is why I give Hard Miles my rating of a checkout. It is a high checkout, but a checkout nonetheless. And very much like the film that I reviewed previously before the break, Unsung Heroes, I think Hard Miles is a great film to see to get you motivated, but I do think that some of the editing here, particularly the placement of the montages, in addition to a relatively vague written epilogue at the very end, which almost reminds you that the students here that are doing this bike ride with Matthew Modine's character are composite characters and not actual people, takes you out of the film in a bad certain way. But if you are a fan of bike riding, and if you are a biking enthusiast who isn't like me, who jumps off the bike and walks their way up the hill, I think you will certainly enjoy this film. I did love Matthew Modine and Cynthia McWilliams in this movie. I just think there were some other parts that were lacking that, with better editing, probably would have made Hard Miles a better film. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Beast. And if you think this is a take on Beauty and the Beast, you might be a little disappointed. It is a French film that was released in its native France as a co-production between France and Canada in 2023. And it's a film that does have some supernatural elements to it, but the supernatural elements are a bit more science fiction than they are fantasy. But it is a science fiction romantic drama film that is directed and written by Bertrand Bonello, from a story he wrote with Guillaume Brood and Benjamin Charbet. I hope I pronounced those names correctly, because those names are French. It is also loosely based on Henry James's 1903 novel, The Beast in the Jungle. The stars of the film include Léa Seydoux, who is French, and George MacKay, who I don't believe is, or at least there are scenes where he speaks French fluently here, but I don't think he's actually from France. Actually, let me just look that up to be sure. He is not. He is actually a British actor. But, man, he speaks French very well in this film. And this is a film that is a bit hard to describe, but it takes place in the near future. And I think the year that was presented here was the year 2044. So it's a relatively distant future. It's 20 years from now, but hopefully when I become a famous film critic, not just the film critic that I am right now, but just saying. But anyway, in the near future, emotions have become a threat, and a woman by the name of Gabrielle, who's played by Léa Seydoux, finally decides to purify her DNA in a machine that will plunge her into past lives and rid her of all strong feelings. She then meets a man by the name of Louis in the 1903 or somewhere around there, and feels a powerful connection as if she had always known him. The story unfolds over three distinct periods: 1910, 2014, and 2044. Now, for the middle year here, 2014, I'm not sure exactly why it took place in 2014 as opposed to 2023 or 2024, but it doesn't exactly matter. I think actually 2014 might be one of those years where America was going through a certain kind of change, and people weren't exactly as aware of that change as they are now. And I could go into what those changes are, but I only have a limited time for this review. So this movie, in a sense, reminds me not so much of Henry James's novella, because I've read some of Henry James's work, and man, even though Henry James writes in English, his stories are very challenging for novice readers. And I think in a sense, Henry James is a bit more like Jane Austen in the sense that he writes about people and he writes about what's going through their minds and their emotions internally, but is not really factoring in external factors. In other words, Henry James writes these characters as if they were in a vacuum. And I have to say that makes for a very challenging read for people who aren't particularly accustomed to internal struggles being put on paper, but they do make for very intriguing characters, and that's why Henry James has lasted as long as he had in terms of his legacy, just maybe not had the same sort of mainstream success as Jane Austen has. And I do compare him to Jane Austen because Jane Austen, very much like Henry James, is very divisive. I mean, there are some big devotees to Jane Austen, but there are also some detractors as well. Again, that's another subject into which I could get, but I'm going to move on because there's a lot to say about this film. This film certainly does not follow a particular pattern of the typical 7 or 14 stories that come out for Hollywood films. It is a film that deals a lot with a woman's emotions as well as the man with whom she keeps connecting in all these past lives. And that can be particularly jarring, particularly because some of these past lives have people in it as well as incantations of Gabrielle and Louis that are particularly jarring. These are people who sometimes are approachable, but other times they're not particularly likable. But that's the point of the film as I was watching it. And there are certainly, very much like Henry James' stories, some challenging parts where it feels like the movie is going particularly slowly, and it also feels like it's pretentious in some parts. But you have to keep going with the story because eventually it does deal with a very jarring and also unexpected climax towards the end, especially when you meet George MacKay's character, Louis, in 2014. He's doing what a lot of people with smartphones and Instagram accounts do for attention. In other words, he's very hard on himself. He doesn't particularly have any prospects. And because he spends so much time alone, he tends to blame certain elements of the outside world for some of the challenges that he's facing internally. In other words, he's very hard on himself. He's self-deprecating to a fault. And how does this intersect with Gabrielle's story? Well, in this 2014 story, or this 2014 section of the film, Gabrielle is a struggling model in Los Angeles, California, who is making ends meet by house-sitting for wealthy people. And, of course, having a place to live temporarily and getting paid for it is a pretty good gig. There aren't a ton of responsibilities there. But when Louis gets into Gabrielle's life in a bad way, she finds that there are certain challenges. But in the period of 1910, Gabrielle is a successful artist and Louis is a member of the bourgeoisie. And even though Gabrielle is married to another man by the name of Pope Kelly, who's played by Guslagi Malanda, again, another name that I hope I pronounced correctly, she does develop a connection with Louis, who's also played in this point of time by George MacKay, that is palpable. Now, is that connection the same as their other past life in 2014, as well as her current life in 2044? The movie doesn't exactly get into that. And the movie does also get into some of her other relationships, including in 2044, particular beings that might not be flesh and blood. In other words, AI is a big controversy as well as a big deal right now. But this movie also seems to suggest that AI might be a bit more dangerous later, but without being as exploitatively dangerous as, say, in The Matrix, for example. Because this movie does have science fiction elements, but the science fiction is more of a supporting character than the lead character. So The Beast is a film that is probably going to get a lot of people talking in a very good way, but the film is certainly challenging to people who might not be familiar with Henry James' work or are more casual moviegoers. But in terms of my take on it, having seen it and putting aside some certain biases that I have about particularly ambitious films like this that might seem ambitious to a fault, I think The Beast does more right than it does wrong, which is one of the reasons why I give this movie my rating of a knockout. And even though there are times where the characters of Gabrielle and Louis make some poor choices and might not seem like particularly likable people, they are still intriguing regardless. And also the unique cinematography as Gabrielle is going into these past lives in her present 2044 are certainly intriguing, and there are images that you will never forget. In addition to characters here that you will never forget, sometimes it feels a little pretentious, but when you get into the film and the characters in the grand scheme of things, there actually is a lot that this film says that is very unique and is certainly a film that would be appealing to lovers of the Criterion Collection, for example. And if The Beast enters the Criterion Collection months from now, I won't be surprised. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Kim's Video. This is a film that is a documentary about a certain well-known video store that existed in the East Village of Manhattan in New York City and has been described as the go-to place for rare selections and widely known amongst the people in New York City of new, experimental, and esoteric music and film. The owner of this video and music store is a man by the name of Youngman Kim, who was an immigrant of North Korea, who started out in running a dry cleaning business before eventually moving into the video rental industry, which was very lucrative in the 80s. He started his first store on Avenue A in 1987 and then expanded to five other locations. And the original Avenue A location closed in 2004 and eventually, in 2008, Youngman Kim closed Kim's Video stores entirely. And the reason he closed those stores is not entirely surprising, because video rental became a money pit as soon as video streaming from the likes of Netflix and Hulu and others became mainstream. But now that video stores have largely gone the way of the dinosaurs, with a few exceptions, a lot of people are looking at video stores nostalgically the same way that when CDs became popular, there became vinyl enthusiasts who held on to the idea of collecting vinyl records, and it worked very well for them because as soon as CDs dwindled in popularity and sales, vinyl went up and it's still continuing to rise. And there are vinyl enthusiasts who are better known as music enthusiasts in the sense that vinyl has a sound to which, according to vinyl enthusiasts, no other digital platform, including MP3s or CDs, have been able to match. Video stores, on the other hand, have not been opening up as much as previously, but that may change, especially when the makers of this documentary, David Redman and Ashley Sabin, have a very nostalgic feel for this particular video store in Manhattan. And this is a store I had never previously heard of. I had stayed in New York City for a while when I was doing internships, and there were some video stores in Brooklyn and other places like that that not only supplied hard-to-find movies, but also had a devoted following like Kim's Video does. And I'm pretty nostalgic about where I could get DVDs and also some videotapes of films that hadn't been released on DVD yet and probably never would. But what made Kim's Video most especially lucrative, at least from a film lover's or cinephile's perspective, was that young man Kim and his employees sought out films that were never commercially released in the United States, not even at the movies. So sometimes Kim's Video would have bootlegs of certain films that were never released in the United States in their presumably true and uncut form. And sometimes they'd get visited by the FBI, who would take those films as a result of copyright infringement. But then young man Kim brought the videos right back to the stores. And surprisingly, he didn't get in trouble with the FBI other than some copyright infringement claims that had the FBI come and take the videos for themselves. But where the film takes off and gets particularly interesting is that there is a small town in Italy that once young man Kim closed his Kim Video stores, actually wanted the videos for themselves, so they would, according to them, create a never-ending film festival where these videos would be played on loop over and over again and sometimes preserved digitally. What happened was that young man Kim approved this small Italian town's proposal to get these videos to their town. But what happened afterwards was basically that the videos just sat in an empty apartment and collected dust, in addition to the fact that the apartment also collected moisture, which is bad for video, particularly for videotapes, because eventually all films tend to rot. But the more you can preserve any type of film, be it 8mm, 16mm, videotape, DVD, Blu-ray, 4K, whatever, the more time you can preserve for them in a cold climate, the better. Or at least a cold place where they are less likely to collect moisture, the less likely they are to rot. So David Redman, who not only co-directs this film but also narrates the film, took it upon himself to find out what happened in terms of these videos making it to this small Italian town and just basically sitting there, why the realization for a never-ending film festival was never brought into fruition, and also what would become of these tapes that were just sitting there collecting dust. And he discovers a conspiracy that leads him down a particular rabbit hole. But he also takes it upon himself, with the help of some other cinephiles like himself, to rescue Kim's Video from basically just laying there and not doing anything. So Kim's Video is a film that made me almost wish that I had been in the East Village of Manhattan when Kim's Video was in its heyday, because being a cinephile like myself who grew up in a small town, all I really knew about videos or about movies was what was playing at my local movie theater and also what was at my local video store. And Movie Gallery was a video store that was probably third to Blockbuster and Hollywood Video. But once they came to my, or came to the surrounding towns in my hometown and bought out all the independent video stores, they monopolized and homogenized the films that they had available. So for instance, if there was a film that was NC-17, they just had the R-rated version of it, even though they also had a porn section in the back, which I never went to because I wasn't old enough. But yeah, Movie Gallery was very frustrating in that regard. So a place like Kim's Video would have been a revelation for me. And I could certainly appreciate somebody who goes out of his way to get uncut videos or uncut movies in their video store, which you can't see anywhere else. Of course, I still stand by the fact that the movie theaters are the best places to see films, but movie theaters can only play so many films and only have so many theaters. So I'm definitely not against the physical media option, and especially considering that streaming services like Netflix and Hulu, yes, they have a lot of options, but they don't have all the options. And they do homogenize their content, arguably the same way that Blockbuster and Movie Gallery did as well. So I was on board with Kim's Video in what they were trying to accomplish, and also their unique and ambitious, not to mention auspicious, selection of films. And I also applauded David Redman for taking a drastic action by basically stealing these videos from their sedentary location and bringing them back to New York where they belonged. I think that there were some elements of this film, like how he acquired his team of cinephiles to help him accomplish this, in addition to also where the Kim's Video, the videotapes and DVDs are now. That was very vaguely detailed here. But I think that Kim's Video could ultimately be made into a dramatized film based on a true story. And I think that dramatized film could easily fill in the blanks of how David Redman accomplished this and also what the aftermath was a little bit more explicitly than this film lets you know. But I still enjoyed Kim's Video. It was obviously shot on a micro budget. I think that David Redman just took a camera that he got from Best Buy to film this movie, but it doesn't really matter what the lighting of the film or the acoustics of the sound is, just as long as it largely tells a good story. I think Kim's Video tells a great story, which is why I give it a marginal knockout. It's marginal because I feel like there were some other elements of this film that could have been detailed, not to mention that when David Redman goes down this rabbit hole of why the film's just sat in a vault, not even a vault, just a barely secure apartment building all this time and didn't become the ambitious never-ending film festival that it was promised to be, I think ultimately some elements of this film were largely dropped. But overall, I applaud David Redman for his love of film, in addition to trying to preserve a part of video and movie watching culture that we don't largely see nowadays. And fortunately, even though you might not have been in New York City when Kim's Video was in its heyday, this film, I think, successfully preserves that part of cinematic as well as American history. And I think it's worth preserving for that reason. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this film, it's now time for me to get into my final segment. Let me say that again. Now that I reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into my final segment, which is what's coming up next. This is a spoken word preview of movies that are subject to being released in theaters on Friday, May 3rd. And there are a number of films that are that look like they're going to be good choices to see in theaters, including The Fall Guy, which is the film that's probably going to make the most money next weekend. And this movie is about a Hollywood stuntman by the name of Colt Seavers, who's played by Ryan Gosling, who is a stuntman by day but works as a bounty hunter by night. That kind of sounds like the plot to Drive, which is another film that I loved from about 10 years ago, but that film had its particular controversies. But anyway, Ryan Gosling's character incorporates his stunts into his bounty hunting, flying vehicles over large objects, jumping from impossibly high angles, and other such ambitious stunts to nab the people he and his team are chasing. In addition to Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt also co-stars in this film, and Academy Award nominee Stephanie Hsu. So The Fall Guy is a film that sounds exciting, and Ryan Gosling chooses his film projects very carefully. I can't guarantee it's going to be a great film, but I will see it and let you know what I think on a future show. Another film that is subject to being released in theaters on May 3rd is a film called I Saw the TV Glow. And this film is about two teenage outcasts who bond over their shared love of a scary television show. But the boundary between TV and reality begins to blur after it is mysteriously canceled. Some of the stars of this film include Justice Smith, Jane Schoenbrunn, Fred Durst, yes, that Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit, and Bridget Lundy Payne. So Justice Smith has a bit of a deficit over which he has to overcome, having been in the film The American Society of Magical Negroes. That's the name of the film. I messed that up with industry. But anyway, so I'm going to give him a second chance with this film because I do think he was miscast in the American Society of Magical Negroes. And I also think there were other faults of that film that were not Justice Smith's fault in particular, other than the issues of miscasting. But I Saw the TV Glow sounds like a very intriguing premise. And if I see that film, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. And last but not least, the other movie I'm going to mention here is Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. Now, you must be thinking to yourself, that's already been released into theaters. That's right. And for its 25th anniversary, it's going to be re-released into theaters. And I think now that we've had people, Gen Z and Gen Alpha, who have grown up watching that film, it's gotten more of a nostalgic appreciation than when I went to see it when I was 16 years old. And Star Wars Episode I is probably the better of the prequels between Episode I and Episode III, but it does certainly have its faults and its flaws. Is this a movie that I'm going to review for you next week? No, but I might revisit it. That just about does it for this episode of Words on Film. Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, reminding you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at WBCA or the station as a whole. Until I watch a whole bunch of brand new movies, this is Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.